What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Jay Geller, author of the new book, The Shalems, a story of the German Jewish bourgeoisie from emancipation to destruction. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our shinshinim, our young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. This coming Wednesday night, Jews everywhere celebrate the beginning of the great festival of freedom, Passover. It's the ultimate holiday of liberation, and we observe it with a Seder, an orderly ritual celebration teaching the incredible value of freedom by appealing to every one of our senses, immersing attendees in a history feast of freedom. Passover is the most observed of all Jewish holidays, commemorating redemption from slavery and brutal oppression, and rejoicing in the journey to liberation, covenant, and holiness. Children are especially prized at Seder, taught beforehand to chant and read special sections, invited to rejoice in the many educational games and songs woven throughout the Haggadah, the book that guides us through the journey from slavery to freedom. In fact, the youngest person at the Passover table must ask the four questions early in the Seder. These begin with a famous phrase, Manishtana halayla hazeh mikol halelot. Why is this night different from all other nights? This year is indeed different. This year, for the first time in decades or maybe centuries, we cannot gather with family and friends to celebrate the Passover. In a season of pandemic, we're restricted to our own household and perhaps close relatives and the most trusted and medically scrupulous of our friends. Some of us cannot even do that, locked into quarantine, sheltering in place, deprived of the close contact of family and friends that make Passover really great. This year, we are not free. We may not be slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, but we live in fear of plague, of illness, and potential death. We huddle in confined spaces. This Seder, when we talk of the pain of human bondage, we also taste the severe limitations of the life of the slave, even before we bite into matzah or horseradish. Near the beginning of the Passover Seder, we proclaim, "Let all who are hungry come and eat." Kol dichvin yeteve yechol. That invitation is usually symbolic, since we already are gathered with a large group of family, friends, guests, to celebrate the many rituals, prayers, songs, and stories reminding us how sacred liberty really is. We dip parsley in salt water to symbolize the taste of the tears of slaves, eat matzah and bitter herbs, unleavened bread and maror that remind us of the bitterness of servitude. We enjoy the homemade charoset that sweetens the bitterness with the taste of freedom. And we talk and drink and eat delicious Passover specialties, asking questions about what freedom means to every person at the extended table. But this year we will all reflect with sadness on those who cannot join us. We, personally, always invite many people to our Passover table. Elders, contemporaries, friends, and acquaintances, both Jewish and non-Jewish. At my home Seder, we have a crowd. Our record is 36 people, while at my own congregation, Beit Simcha, my synagogue, last year our inaugural Seder grew to 107 people, enjoying chicken soup and matzo balls, gefilte fish, greens for the verdant spring, brisket and chicken, and special kugels and delicious traditional foods made especially for Passover. We drink 4 cups of wine over the long evening of Seder, each cup symbolizing one of the great promises of freedom that God gave our people in the book of Exodus. We come, we celebrate freedom, we eat and drink with joy and gusto that only free people can demonstrate. And we Jews set aside special charity, Maot Chitin, to make it possible for those who cannot afford this kind of Passover meal to celebrate without assistance. So, how do we possibly replace that experience in this year so filled with fear, hoarding, and potential death, when instead of the joy of liberation, we are on official lockdown in our own homes? Well, we've always found a way to observe Passover, even in the toughest of times. We will do so this year of coronavirus. At my congregation, Beit Simcha, we're holding a virtual Seder Tuesday night at 6 p.m. All who are hungry for freedom and meaning, please join us on Facebook at Beit Simcha Tucson or on Zoom. You can email to get that address. I will lead a video version of our celebration of freedom and covenant, and anyone can come from anywhere in the world. You know, I can't share my own homemade versions of Charoset in person, but I can share the songs and prayers, the poems and tales reflecting on freedom and holiness in the face of oppression. As we experience just a taste of the oppression our ancestors faced in Egypt, we can gather virtually to embrace the potential for freedom that God granted us so very long ago. This year we are not yet free, but next year, may we all celebrate a Passover of true freedom from fear and restriction. To play us in this morning, here's Yehoram Gaon, the great Sephardic Jewish singer, giving us a Moroccan version of Who Knows What, Ken Supiense.
Ken Supiense, entendiense, alavar al Dio creense, qualo es el uno, qualo es el uno. Uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cuáles son los dos, cuáles son los dos. Dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, cuáles son los tres. ¿Cuáles son los tres? Tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón. Uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, ¿cuáles son los cuatro? ¿Cuáles son los cuatro? Cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, ¿cuáles son los cinco? ¿Cuáles son los cinco? Cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo. Ken supiense y entendiense, alabar al Dio creense, ¿cuáles son los sesh? ¿Cuáles son los sesh? Sesh días de la semana, cinco libros de la ley, cuatro madres de Israel, tres nuestros padres son, dos de Moshe y Aarón, uno es el Creador, uno es el Creador, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shemo.
That was Yehoram Gaon singing the Seder song, Who Knows One, in Ladino, the beautiful language that blends medieval Spanish and Hebrew, for Passover, beginning Wednesday night, April 8th. Or you can join our virtual Seder Tuesday night, April 7th at 6 p.m. on Facebook and Zoom. Just go to the Congregation Beit Simcha Facebook page. You can even download the Haggadah we'll be using for free. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more details, or tojewishradio18@gmail.com. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Professor Jay Geller, will introduce us to the incredible history of the extraordinary German-Jewish scholar Gershom Scholem through his remarkable family, a story of greatness and tragedy, Find out all about it when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring, and we've now got them all on Zoom and Facebook. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Our synagogue location is at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times in these days of coronavirus tsoris. Join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m., also on Zoom. And Saturday morning, Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m. on our Facebook page. It's Beit Simcha Tucson on Facebook. We'll be holding our services with full music by virtual experience weekly for, well, the time being. All of our adult education academy classes and our religious school classes are held on Zoom. You can access by emailing us at beitsimchatucson.org. Our synagogue at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, is at the entrance to the Foothills Mall, not in the mall, but in our own building. But for now, we are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook. And our virtual Seder is coming this Tuesday at 6 p.m. Go to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, to join in. You can even download the Haggadah in advance. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHATucson.org, to get more information. For more about Beit Simcha and to attend services, our great religious school, Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, all taught on Zoom, and of course all of our services on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish community in all of southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Jay Geller is the Samuel Rosenthal Professor of Judaic Studies at Case Western in Cleveland area. He has a new book out, The Sholems, a story of the German Jewish bourgeoisie from emancipation to destruction. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I have to say, as a teacher of Zohar, Gershom Sholem always comes up early on when I'm teaching about Kabbalah as one of the most fascinating individuals ever to study mysticism. That is far from the homeland of German Jewish life in which he grew up. Can you tell us a little bit about the Sholem family, how they rose to prominence and where they all came from, I guess?
For the time of Gershom Sholem's youth, his family was an old Berlin Jewish family, but they were only three or four generations removed from their roots in Poland. The family grew up in, or originated in Glogau. It's a small city or large town in Silesia, and Prussia had conquered it from Austria in the 1840s. The Sholems were presumably living there at the time. But in 1812, during the Napoleonic Wars, the Prussian government emancipated its Jews. It gave them the right to move wherever they wanted within Prussia. It also required them to take last names, and it's at that time that the Sholem family became the Sholems, and his ancestors moved from Glogau to Berlin, presumably for economic reasons, And that was the start of their very slow but steady ascent into the ranks of the upper middle class.
Now, to say that they were assimilated Jews wouldn't quite capture it. Can you describe kind of the cultural milieu of those Berlin Jews, particularly this, obviously the Scholem family itself?
Jews like the Scholems knew that they were different from other Germans. Yes, they certainly thought of themselves as German, and they were proud to be German for the most part. But they realized that they were a different subculture within the German community, if you will. So in my book, I argue that the Scholems are representative of this milieu, especially in Berlin, of German Jews who are both German and Jewish, and finding a unique way for themselves to be both German and Jewish. And in this, they represent a unique subculture that, to them, was highly recognizable, that they had a sense of you're in our community or not in our community, and they had a shared sense of politics, religion, all sorts of cultural aesthetics, even a certain patois that they would sometimes use with each other. So they were certainly Jewish, and they were certainly German, and they saw themselves as both.
Now, knowing that they were both, that didn't mean that they were supposed to become scholars of Judaism, and we'll explore particularly Gershom Scholem, but also the evolution of the family as kind of exemplars of that German-Jewish culture when we come back with Jay Geller here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com, toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Freedom Index, whether countries are free or not free. It seems like a really good topic right before Pesach. That's not the only index that tells you kind of if it's a good country or a fair place.
Right. Truth be told, I had never heard of this index before you brought it up with me, and I don't know what their methodology is. There's an index in which I place a great deal of faith, which is called the Corruption Perceptions Index, and it's produced by an organization called Transparency International, and it's produced every year. Transparency International is, perhaps ironically, based in Berlin, but has an international staff, and the acronym, just by chance, is the same as the Consumer Price Index. And there are people who think, oh, that was intentional so that people would take the Corruption Perceptions Index more seriously than it ought to be taken.
The CPI.
Right.
Correction.
But here's the thing that this index measures, which is it polls the business community, the banking community, the investment community, and it asks a bunch of specific questions about how easy it is it to do business in country X, how much do you have to bribe, how are laws enforced, a bunch of questions basically that reveal collectively the degree to which a country is really characterized by the rule of law or is characterized by just, you know, the Wild West ethic of whoever has the biggest gun or the biggest bribe. And the results are not surprising. They're not that different from the results of your Freedom Index. in the sense that countries like New Zealand, Norway, Finland are near the top. The U.S. is pretty close. We might be like number 12 from the top. And countries like China, but even more so Nigeria, Moldova, other countries are really low.
I should note that on that index, as on the Freedom Index, in the Middle East, Israel is like unbelievably stellar compared to any of its neighbors. No great surprise there either.
Right. And, you know, this largely tracks how willing foreign investors are to take a stake in a country. Mm-hmm. And tells countries, in effect, here's what you might have to do to create a better environment for foreign direct investment. But what I found most interesting about this is that the single greatest correlation between the degree of corruption perceived by the world community and anything else is between how well a country does at managing environmental issues, because that's an indication of public participation. Does the government take into consideration the wants and needs of its citizens, or does it just seek to line its pockets? And it makes sense when you think about it that there's this virtuous circle of wise environmental stewardship, public participation in decision-making, and a lack of corruption. Those things are clearly related. And once you move that circle in the other direction and turn up the corruption and turn down environmental management, you basically ruin a country for the sake of a few oligarchs. Or you completely destroy the RLC, which was the case in Uzbekistan, because the Soviets initially and then the government in Tashkent dictated that you had to produce cotton. So they completely drained the RLC and turned it into like this toxic waste dump. And not surprisingly, that's one of the most corrupt countries in the world.
Fascinating. Well, I hope that we can maintain transparency and make my personal wish, both America and Israel, rise in that particular CPI. Thanks, Tom, and Chag Sameach v'Kasher, a good and a safe and a healthy Pesach.
Also to you and your family.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A blind man sits down on a park bench during Pesach. The rabbi walks over and sits down next to him, takes out his lunch, including, of course, Pesach, Passover matzah. Seeing the blind man has nothing to eat, taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of matzah and gives it to the blind man. Several minutes later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on the shoulder, and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. That was our Passover edition, or in this case, pre-Pesach edition.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Daniel Levy and Shai Friedwald, young representatives of Israel. Boker Tov.
Boker Lov, Dug Sameach.
And it's almost Chag Sameach. We're getting close to Pesach. Tell us about the experience of preparing for Pesach in Israel.
With one word, terrorism. No, I'm kidding. But it's when my mom does the Pesach cleaning, my brother and I just said we need to escape as far as possible for this year. It's just my dad at home, so that poor guy has to deal with it. But my mom just cleans everything in the house. She cleans the dishes. She has to make it kosher, take everything with gluten and just like seal it in a box and hide it somewhere. And it's
put
a
it in
a
cupboard,
mess.
Seal the
yeah.
cupboard.
Just bring right. all the matzah.
And your family isn't religious, right?
This They're
is
not,
just
but...
A very yeah. normal thing to do in Israel. Like, you yes. really do the Pesach cleaning, the real spring cleaning, right?
We do.
And how about in your... Sounds delightful. And
You're
how
welcome
about
to come.
Yeah, yeah, maybe I'll come after help. Pesach. I've been in Israel for Pesach, by the way,
yeah.
A couple times. Shai, how about you? What's it like for you guys?
So also, my mom cleans. And...
Do you help?
She doesn't want us to help so much because she all the time she has recommendations and then do that and that and then she's being upset with that. But a lot of times she also throws all the chametz,
right.
like the non doughy things.
Non-kosher for Pesach.
Yeah. And, but we try to keep something for us during the Chag, comments. During the holiday, so we will be able to eat something else than matzah, with chocolate, with butter, wet matzah. Did you ever try wet matzah?
I've had matzah every way. I don't like it anyway. But okay. Wet matzah is what? Like matzah just, braai? Like you
no,
soak
no.
it in water?
You just put it in water.
Uh-huh.
And then you put butter and salt, and it's soft. And
so
it's
you must
good.
Put soft butter because it's soft now after you put it in water, right?
Right. Just like the texture is, it's nice. It's so pleasant.
It's not leavened. It's just not. I'm sorry. For me, matzah is lechem oni, like really the poor excuse for bread. But so.
Just for Pesach, you know.
Yeah, but chocolate is, kosher for Pesach, chocolate, kosher for Pesach, butter, not a problem, butter and salt. But if you put butter and salt on cardboard, it would probably taste okay.
The same. So.
Exactly. Matzah is the only thing that tastes exactly like the package it comes in. So what do you guys do? You have a Seder the first night. What do you do for Pesach?
It's my birthday.
It's your birthday.
It's always my birthday on Pesach.
Does that mean you always get a Pesach cake for
it
your
does.
Birthday?
Oh. And funny story, last year, so my mom makes me always this Pesach cake. Yeah. And it's made out of almond flour.
Right.
So it's always really good. It's one of my favorite cakes. She makes it really good. But last year she did it with seasoned almond flour by accident,
no.
Which means it had, you know,
salt
like a seed.
And stuff
exactly.
In it?
It was salty. It was very
weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's a one to remember.
You'll always remember that she used the wrong flour for your cake. Yeah. And my mom used to always moan that her birthday, may she rest in peace, that her birthday, it was April 8th, it always came on Pesach, which meant she always got some form of sponge cake with strawberries or something. And it was, well, I hope you have a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, as we say, a good and a kosher Pesach. And I hope your birthday cake is delicious this
Thank
year
you.
Without any weird seasoning in it. And I hope that the wet matzo with the butter and salt is, you can do that anywhere in the world, right?
Try. You will thank me after.
All right. We'll see. Thanks. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
And now a word of Torah. This week we read a series of special Torah selections for the holiday of Passover, reflecting the text of the Exodus from Egypt and our liberation from the hands of Pharaoh and his minions, as well as all the rituals of the Pesach celebration. The climactic Torah reading for the final day of Passover will ultimately be the magnificent Song of Moses, the Az Yashir Moshe, greatest extended poem in the whole Torah. The Torah reading on Shabbat this week is from Ki Tisa. It includes the laws of the festivals and the Shlosh Esrei Midot, the declaration of the 13 attributes of God chanted in the Torah service on each festival. But this Passover Sabbath, we will also read an unusual section that's not from the Torah at all. It's an addition from the last section of the Hebrew Bible, the Ketuvim, called Shir HaShirim, the great Song of Songs. The Song of Songs is the ultimate love poem of the Bible, a beautiful and confusing hymn to human physical love, unequaled in Western religious literature. Shir HaShirim Asher LiShlomo. This is the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, it begins, and then it gets really hot. It is a nearly postmodern text in which the voice changes with every chapter and within every chapter. You're not always sure who's speaking. One man? One woman? Two women? A group? You aren't always sure to whom the gorgeous love poetry is being addressed. It's a rich, swirling tapestry of love and desire. A perfect text for the springtime of the year, when our hearts turn to the thoughts of love and life renewed. But the Song of Songs is more even than that. It's a celebration of the gift that God has given us to love freely, with our bodies as well as our souls. In married human love, Judaism sees an opportunity for joy and holiness, for sanctifying life through physical and emotional fulfillment. What a great, sexy gift in this verdant time of this very strange year. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Professor Jay Geller, will tell us what happened to the great scholar of Jewish mysticism, Gershom Scholem, when he left Germany, all about his family and his relationships with them. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Adam Schlesinger, one of the lead songwriters of the pop rock band Fountains of Wayne and the musical series Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, died last week at the age of 52 from coronavirus complications. Schlesinger grew up in a secular Jewish home, had been in an unnamed hospital in upstate New York for over a week. Fountains of Wayne's most famous song was Stacy's Mom, for which Schlesinger and co-songwriter Chris Collingwood were nominated for two Grammys in 2003. He did win a Grammy in 2010 for A Colbert Christmas, the greatest gift of all, that he composed stuff for Stephen Colbert. In addition, Adam Schlesinger garnered a host of Oscar, Tony, and Emmy nominations, including an Oscar nod in 1997 for writing an original song in the Tom Hanks film That Thing You Do, two Tony nominations for the musical Crybaby in 2008, and Emmy nominations for songs on Sesame Street.
Now it's time to celebrate. Grab a drink and fix a plate. But before you feel too great, remember that we suffered. Nights like these are filled with glee, noshing, dancing, singing, wee! But we sing in a minor key to remember that we suffered.
Being happy is selfish. Remember that we suffered.
You have no idea what pain is.
Remember that we suffered. Hey!
In recent years, Schlesinger worked on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the very Jewish musical show that aired for four seasons on TV. He co-wrote a majority of the show's music and won an Emmy for the song Antidepressants Are So Not a Big Deal, alongside the show's creator and star, Rachel Bloom, and Jack Dolgen. Adam Schlesinger was most recently at work adapting Sarah Silverman's memoir, The Bedwetter, into a musical. It was set to begin performances off-Broadway April 25th. That has obviously been delayed due to the pandemic. Schlesinger was also at work adapting The Nanny for Broadway with Rachel Bloom. He is a sad loss. May his memory and his music remain a blessing.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
As the highly contagious coronavirus spreads around the world, Israel and the Palestinians struggle to contain a local outbreak that has virtually halted daily life and led tens of thousands of people to enter quarantine. Well, over 7,000 Israelis have so far tested positive for coronavirus. As we go to air, more than 30 people have died, over 100 are in serious condition, and close to 100 are on life support. One Israeli tourist died while in Italy. So far, 250 or so have recovered. In the West Bank, 130 cases have been diagnosed so far. That's probably an underdiagnosis. One woman has died. In Gaza, just 12 cases have been diagnosed, the first two after returning from Pakistan. Israel's government has intensified restrictions on movement, banned public gatherings, including for prayer, that is, you can't go to shul, limited outings to two people from the same household. Authorities have also called upon Israelis to wear face masks in public to better protect themselves and others from the virus. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu has said Israel will limit movement to and from the largely ultra-Orthodox city of Bnei Brak, which has become a hotspot for spread of the virus. Coronavirus is spreading faster in ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods throughout Israel than anywhere else. In Bnei Brak, Israel's largest ultra-Orthodox city, 35% of coronavirus tests have come back positive. 35%. Israel is now considering placing the whole area under quarantine. The reasons for this high level of infection include a lack of social distancing enforcement, crowded living conditions, and a dearth of information that is both scientifically sound and presented in a manner that the majority of the community is able or willing to comprehend. The Haredi population that knows very little about science is not terribly well equipped to comprehend the threat of viruses, and a person who's never learned basic math cannot be expected to understand graphs about flattening the curve. When a population that regards its religious leaders as infallible are told that the Torah will protect them and that secular law enforcement agencies are either Nazis or anti-Semites, there is little motivation to comply with those orders. It's easy for them to underestimate the risk of virus. It hasn't helped that Yaakov Litzman, Israel's Minister of Health, who is Haredi himself, believes that this pandemic is going to end by messianic intervention. Litzman himself tested positive for coronavirus last week. During a time when the lines between health and defense may be blurred, it could turn out to be a very deadly mistake that Benny Gantz has helped form the new government and taken the Ministry of Defense, while, despite the urging of senior medical officials, leaving Litzman in charge of public health. Last week also saw Bibi Netanyahu enter quarantine for the second time after having contact with Health Minister Litzman. And the head of the Mossad, Israel's famed secret service, also went into quarantine after exposure to coronavirus. In other not-such-good news, Rick Wiles, the Florida pastor who claimed the effort to impeach Trump was a Jew coup, has said that the spread of coronavirus in synagogues is a punishment of the Jewish people for opposing Jesus. Wiles made the claim last week on his True News broadcast. The people who are going into the synagogue or coming out of the synagogue with the virus, said Wiles. It's spreading in Israel through the synagogues. God is spreading it in your synagogues. You are under judgment because you oppose his son, Jesus Christ. That is why you have a plague in your synagogues. Repent and believe in the name of Jesus Christ and the plague will stop. A lot of medical science behind that, of course. The vile anti-Semite Wiles also claims that the U.S. outbreak started at the AIPAC conference in Washington, D.C. In fact, the first case and the first outbreak were both reported in Washington State, not Washington, D.C. Wiles probably can't tell the difference. In November, Wiles called the impeachment of Donald Trump a Jew coup and said the Jews will also kill millions of Christians. Wiles' website regularly releases anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, and homophobic videos. In February, True News was permanently banned from YouTube, but Wiles continues to receive media credentials from the Trump White House. And in somewhat sad news, Nathan Al's Deli in Beverly Hills, the morning gathering place for Larry King, before him George Burns and many other Jewish members of Hollywood's elite, has closed for good because of coronavirus. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Jay Geller is the Samuel Rosenthal Professor of Judaic Studies at Case Western. He's the author of the new book, The Sholems, a story of the German Jewish bourgeoisie from emancipation to destruction. Earlier in the show, we talked about their emancipation, moving to Berlin, knowing that they were the Sholems were a German family. They certainly had a strong sense of German identity, but also different in that they were Jewish. What was their sort of religious observance like?
In Gershom's youth, they were a family that would have been described somewhat pejoratively as three-day Jews. They went to synagogue on Rosh Hashanah, they went to synagogue on Yom Kippur, and that was essentially it for synagogue observance.
And by the way, that would describe a lot of American Jews today, so with maybe Pesach thrown in.
And the Sholem celebrated Pesach as well. So their synagogue observance was limited, but they did have a sense of themselves as Jews, and they had a sense of themselves as observing certain Jewish holidays, but perhaps not in the way that someone more conventionally religious would have done. So they would gather on Friday nights for family dinner, and they would do some sort of Shabbat ritual. They would not go to synagogue on Saturday. They wouldn't do really anything on Saturday morning that we would consider to be Shabbat observance. And then on Pesach, they would have seders. They would gather at the home of an uncle, Theobald, and they would have something akin to what we think of as a traditional Seder. But for them, it was really about family time and about creating a Jewish ritual that was almost a personalized Judaism for themselves.
In that 3-day-a-year, I guess, plus Pesach, we always talk about 3-day-a-year Jews, but I think the most observed holiday for German Jews probably was Passover, as it is for American Jews. In that experience, they expected their children to remain Jewish, but they didn't necessarily expect them to become deeply involved professionally. They thought they would stay in whatever the family businesses were, that kind of thing. I guess I've heard this story told about how Gershom Scholem himself, who became this incredible scholar of Judaism, became so immersed. Can you retell that story a little bit?
Sure. His father, Arthur, owned a print shop, as had his grandfather, Siegfried. So they were a long-standing family of printers, and Gershom's brothers were also printers. And the expectation in the family was exactly, as you said, just the opposite, that they would not become scholars of Judaism, and that was actually somewhat looked down upon. It was considered to be a little peculiar, to be honest. But as Gershom was growing up, in an environment where anti-Semitism existed as white noise in the background of their world, and really spiked during the era of World War I, he felt that his family was not recognizing the reality of the situation, that they were not really at home in Germany. There was something out of place. Moreover, as he grew up, he felt that his parents' Judaism had become desiccated, had lost all meaning. They would do a Shabbat ritual, they would do a Pesach Seder, but he felt that it was devoid of real spirituality. And so he was looking for something more. And he was not alone in this, although there is a conventional wisdom that his generation of German Jews were highly assimilated or acculturated. The fact is that he was part of a community of other like-minded young German Jews who were looking for more and sought a sort of regeneration of Jewish identity in various guises, whether it be religious or cultural, could be political. So Zionism was one aspect of that for him and for his peers. He also, of course, became a great scholar of Judaism. And in many ways, he was looking to have a renaissance of Jewish learning that he felt would regenerate the Jewish spirit and the Jewish people.
That renaissance actually took place in the 1930s. I think of the Lehrer House, this sort of young German Jewish fascination with their own heritage, which had been, as you said, kind of desiccated, dried out, turned into something kind of cold and antiseptic. I'm not saying that German Jews aren't as emotional as other Jews, but they aren't. So tell us a little bit about how Scholem participated in and kind of became, I think, really seminal to that.
It's interesting that he was part of this wider movement, and yet at the same time, he was opposed very strongly to certain aspects of it. So he and Franz Rosenzweig, the leader of the Lehrer House, had a kind of antagonistic friendship. And ultimately...
I just got to say, that's a great phrase, antagonistic friendship. It sounds like something Jews in particular can manage.
Yeah, I think it's something that young people today might call the frenemy.
Yeah, that's right.
So they were in some ways working along the same track, but in antagonism to each other, because Gershom really felt that the Jews of Germany, and perhaps the diaspora more widely speaking, should come to Palestine, should come to Eretz Israel, and that should be the center of the Jewish spiritual cultural renaissance, whereas Franz Rosenzweig and his peers were working to create a renaissance of Jewish culture, Jewish sensibility inside of Germany, to make Jews more comfortable with their Judaism, their Jewishness in Germany, where Scholem thought that was a lost cause, and they should admit that. And yet, they're really drawing on the same wellspring of the early 20th century, where there is a community of German Jews looking for more and trying to do more with Jewish identity and Jewish learning.
You know, I always think about Scholem's own work as so fascinating because he's studying, in particular, mysticism, Kabbalah, and yet he studies it as a German scholar. Everything is so analytical, and he's talking about something mystical and spiritual, collecting all of this information accurately, presenting it accurately, but in this, you know, such an orderly, structured way with footnotes, with great detail. It's such a contrast. Was he aware of that?
I think he was, and I think that's a very accurate description of what he's doing, that he's taking something that had long been seen as obscure, anormative, and based in perhaps either superstitions or emotions, and bringing it into the academic world. He's essentially drawing on the German university academic tradition and applying it to a really unusual niche study of Judaism. I mean, I think it's pretty accurate to say that if it weren't for him, we wouldn't be having conversations today about the Zohar and about Kabbalah, that he brings it into the mainstream of study, if not the mainstream of practice. I think he was aware of that. And then later on, when he becomes a major figure at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, he's trying to apply German standards of academic rigor and scholarship to the endeavor of university study and academic study in Eretz Yisrael early on.
Tell us, he sees the signs maybe sooner, of course, than many of his family. Tell us about his journey to Israel, kind of reestablishing himself, and then what happens to the Sholem family.
He decides very early on that he wants to make Aliyah. He finishes his doctorate at the University of Munich in 1923, and then he goes to Eretz Yisrael right around Yom Kippur of that year. He and Shlomo Goitein actually take the boat together to Egypt, and then he continues on up to Jaffa, where he's met by his fiancée. He came to Israel, the land of Israel, very early on as a librarian. Was technically what he was coming over with his visa. But then once the university gets going, he's given a lectureship. He knew, again, from a very young age that this is what he wanted to do. His family thought this was peculiar at best, and they were opposed to it. His brothers, his mother stayed in Germany. His father died in 1925, and his three brothers and his mother basically stayed almost until the end in Germany. His next oldest brother, Werner, was a high-ranking figure in the German Communist Party. He was arrested by the Nazis in 1933, sent to concentration camps, and never let out. And he was murdered in Buchenwald in 1940. His mother and his surviving two brothers managed to get out in 1938 and 1939, and they went, of all places, to Sydney, Australia.
Mm.
It's hard to think of some place farther away from Berlin than Sydney.
Although I will say, there's the great Sydney Jewish community. I happened to work there for 4 months a while back. Made up primarily these days of people who got out either right before or refugees after the Holocaust.
So they were part of that community, and even in that community, they did recognize themselves as different, as German Jews, and they had a pretty German Jewish circle of acquaintances and friends in Sydney. But to answer your question, his relatives really didn't see themselves as needing to get out until, of course, the Nazi years. And until the Nazi years were pretty advanced and things were getting very, very bad for the Jews. They visited Gershom in Jerusalem several times in the 1920s and 1930s, but there really was no thought of making Aliyah really until the very, very latest years, 1938, 1939. And even then, it was essentially too late, and so they went to Australia.
You know, so many of the families who were destroyed by, or at the very least, severely damaged by the Holocaust, remained in contact, but of course it was never the same. What evolved for the Sholem family, which was such a strong and integral community?
So throughout his life, Gershom had a very extensive correspondence with his mother, and those letters formed the basis of much of the book. He also had a fairly extensive correspondence with his oldest brother, Reinhold, and that correspondence continued really into the 1980s. You have these two men who are now octogenarians, still writing each other back and forth between Jerusalem and Sydney, still arguing about whether the Jews had ever been at home in Germany, whether they had been deluding themselves, whether there had been another option, a different path they could have taken. And Reinhold, who is now quite old, still insists that at some level he is still a German, that he still has a right to speak German, to think of himself as German, and that he would not let the Nazis tell him what it had meant to be a German. Incidentally, one of the brothers, Eric, who died in 1965, rejected Germany. His attitude was essentially, the Germans took this away from me, they rejected me, I reject them. And he became an Anglophile, a true Australian to some degree. When he went back to Germany to visit, he didn't like it. He had a very bad experience, whereas Reinhold had a pretty good experience going back to Europe and to Germany in the 1970s. So this was a long point of contention for them as they continued to have their correspondence, and they would see each other occasionally meeting in Europe. Gershom, of course, would go to European universities to give guest lectures, and on a few occasions his brothers could meet him there. What is interesting is that when his mother left Germany in 1939, she never left Australia again, and she never saw Gershom again. They saw each other once as her ship passed through the Suez Canal at Port Said, And that was the last time they ever saw each other, despite their very close relationship.
That's fascinating. I mean, he could have traveled to see her, no?
He could have, exactly. And I've often wondered, why didn't he? Of course, during the war years, that was an impossibility.
Yeah, of course.
But she lived until 1947. He could have made it a priority to get down to Australia. Even in his last few months of life, he was invited to his brother's 90th birthday party down in Sydney, and he had plans to go. And then he decided not to go to recover or rest at a Swiss spa in advance of taking up a fellowship at Berlin. I sometimes wonder whether he really didn't want to go, whether it was more than just the journey, but something about seeing his family and confronting the fact that while they had to leave Germany, the story did, for some of them, have a happy ending, that it did not end in utter tragedy, the way it did, of course, for his brother Werner. But Reinhold had a successful and happy life in Australia after he was forced to leave Germany.
And of course, Gershom Scholem himself became really one of the legendary scholars of Judaism and a tremendous academic reputation. What surprised you the most in researching this book?
I was very surprised by how many fields, how many disciplines Gershom Scholem touched. Of course, he's renowned as a Jewish studies scholar, but he's held in tremendous esteem by scholars of German literature and language, by scholars of comparative religion, scholars of politics, political science, sociology. He was a man who really was a Renaissance man in the truest sense of the word. He contributed actively to many, many fields, and he was part of the rejuvenation of the Renaissance of many different fields. He also was a real public intellectual. I know it's a term that gets overused, but he really did bring to bear his stature and his tremendous knowledge in other fields, including literature studies, political science, but also active politics. In various moments of his life, he would become very active in Zionist, usually left-wing Zionist politics. And so he was a person whose work and his opinions had great resonance far beyond what we may think of as simply the study of Kabbalah.
I want to thank Professor Jay Geller for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is The Scholems, A Story of the German Jewish Bourgeoisie from Emancipation to Destruction. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about your work?
They can find out more about the book at the Cornell University Press website. They can look up me at the Case Western Reserve University History Department website. And, of course, the book is sold widely on websites such as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and it's always nice to support your local independent bookstore and order through them.
And they need it more now than ever, I would say.
Absolutely.
Jay, thank you so much. Chag Sameach, a happy and a healthy Pesach. Definitely a healthy Pesach to you and your family. Take care. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be the musical theater legend Stephen Schwartz, creator of Pippin, Godspell, Wicked, and the new musical based on The Prince of Egypt, which will debut whenever they let Broadway reopen. Anyway, we're thrilled to have him next week. Don't miss it. Our playout this morning comes from the Jewish People's Philharmonic Chorus. It's their rendition of Chad Gadyah, a mix of Yiddish and English and other languages, the classic Passover Seder song about the only kid. My friends, may you have a healthy week, a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a good and a healthy Pesach, a Zisen Pesach, a Shavua Tov, and a week, we pray, of peace.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.